I was all fired up and, okay, I'm going to Boston. The minute I finished, I was like, I have to come back here.
Welcome to the Shakeout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Van Buskirk. Over the last couple of weeks, we've brought you episodes featuring some of North America's most historic road races. Today is our final installment in our spring road racing mini-series, and we're closing it out in style. In this episode, we take you on the journey from Hopkinton to Boylston with a remarkable Boston Marathon streaker. And no, not that kind of streaker. But first, Canadian running writer Maddie Kelly and I bring you some of last week's tasty results from the road running world. This is The Rundown. Well, Maddie, last week we had a jam-packed rundown, one of arguably the biggest racing weekends in the world across the trails, track, and roads. But this was sort of a lighter weekend, at least for the trails and the track.
Yeah, I mean, because a ton happened on the roads, but the Canadians who did race did a phenomenal job. But there weren't as many heavy-hitting road races because we've got the Boston Marathon a week from now. Yeah, it's coming up. It's coming up quick.
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah, so I think people are just kind of, you know, saving their legs, their energy, their cowbell, all of that.
More cowbell.
Everyone needs more cowbell.
All the time.
Yeah.
All right, so going right into that road news, the race roster spring runoff took place on Saturday in Toronto's High Park. And we knew it was going to be a fast race, particularly on the women's side. It did not disappoint. I was out there on the course and it was super fun to watch. It was also a beautiful day.
It was a perfect day. If you live in Toronto, you know, it's one of those days when like everyone decides to have a barbecue and wash their car.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first time in months where people have done that.
It's like emerging from hibernation.
Yeah, it just, and it smells special.
Yeah,
you know,
it
like
does.
Vaguely of manure, but that's kind of comforting.
Yeah.
I'm from a small town. Can you tell?
we more get the occasional waft of manure in Toronto. It's not as much of a steady presence.
It's not as enduring.
Right. But yes, it was a beautiful day. This was the 42nd running of the spring runoff, making it Toronto's longest continually run road race. And I've done this race before. There are years where it is absolutely brutal weather. So I think everyone who turned up to, well, it was about 8 degrees at race start, sun was shining, no wind. I mean, that course is super challenging. So to have beautiful weather for it makes a big difference.
Huge difference. And also that just means more spectatorship, and more spectators means you run faster.
It also means more cowbell.
It also means more cowbell, bringing us back to our first point.
It all connects, folks.
Yeah.
So our champions on the 8K side were Sarah Inglis and Tristan Woodfine. Mengistu Emebet was second on the women's side after her surprise victory at Around the Bay last week. And she actually led Sarah for a good chunk of the first part of the race. And I think that, I mean, that poor woman, she just came off this huge performance at Around the Bay 30K, you know, less than a week ago. And had to jump into these ridiculous hills in High Park.
Yeah, she told some reporters after that she basically hadn't rested since Around the Bay. This is a really good performance. And we found out that she has been in Canada for 1 year. She's a landed immigrant and she's hoping to obtain Canadian citizenship and potentially represent Canada one day. And if you look at the depth of women's distance running in Canada right now, it's on a huge upswing. And an addition of a woman like her, of her caliber, would be great. It just raises everyone else's performances.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the last couple weeks of performances have showed that. We've had, again, two of the most stacked Canadian women's fields at both Around the Bay and the spring runoff. And, you know, Sarah beat her this past weekend. But other than that, she pretty much demolished some pretty top Canadian women. So it'll up everyone's game for sure.
Absolutely. Speaking of women's depth in the marathon, Emily Setlock and Melanie Morand, killer at Rotterdam.
Unbelievable performances.
Yeah. Melanie Morand's had like an incredible 18 months. She's just like shattered personal bests.
Yeah.
She ran really well. She ended up ninth at Chicago on her birthday last October. Best birthday ever.
Amazing.
And then she improved on that PB, which I believe was, it was 2:34. And then she ran a 2:33 at Rotterdam. So, you know, that's absolutely moving in the right direction, getting closer and closer to that Olympic standard and placing her among some of the top female runners in Canada.
Well, and Emily Setlack ran 2:35.44, just a little bit behind Melanie, which, Maddie, I believe that was an 11-minute personal best.
That was an 11-minute personal best.
Can you imagine?
Oh, you're in a different league. You're in an entirely different league.
Totally.
Which is huge. And Emily Setlack has had a really cool career because she, you know, was great on the track. She was great on the road. She was at the World Half Marathon Championships in March 2018.
That's right.
Then she went to the World Mountain Running Championships in the early fall. And now after, you know, her foray into mountain running and taking some time, you know, away from the structure of the roads and sort of under the freedom of the trails, she drops an enormous PB.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, sometimes a little change of stimulus does a huge amount of good.
Absolutely. But I've also chatted with both Dana Pitereski and Krista Duchesne about this in the last two episodes of The Shakeout and kind of asked both of them their thoughts on this breakthrough in Canadian women's distance running. And, you know, one of the most obvious statements, but they both said it, was that the more women who are performing at this top level, the more, as we just said, you know, with our Ethiopian friend, it ups everyone's game. So I think that there's a plethora of inspiring performances going around that are just kind of creating this cyclical effect.
I mean, it sounds a little cheesy, but it's kind of the why can't I mentality.
Totally.
Yeah.
Speaking of why can't I, John Mason on men's side ran 2:15:15, which was also an enormous breakthrough.
I haven't followed John Mason's career that closely, full disclosure, but from the people who I've talked to who trained with him for years, this wasn't particularly expected. I mean, he was in good shape. People said he was in really good shape going in, but I don't know if they necessarily knew he was in 2:15 shape, which is a 3-minute PB.
Yeah. He was the first North American across the line.
Yeah. Fastest Canadian this year.
That's huge. So congrats to all of our marathoners at Rotterdam. Moving on to some shorter distance races, Edward Cheserek tied the road 5K world record at the Carlsbad 5000 over the weekend, running 13:29 on the roads.
Super fast. Okay, but there's a slight caveat with this record. It's the record, just so we're clear. He has tied the record.
Yes.
But the IAAF only started recognizing 5K road records in November of 2017.
Right.
So all of the 5K times that were run before November 2017 can't be ratified. So the Carlsbad course record is actually 13 flat.
Right.
Which is like
a lot faster.
A lot faster.
But isn't recognized
but isn't recognized as a world record. Not that we are putting down King Ches.
No.
Great. Not. You know, 17-time NCAA champion.
Yeah.
He's an amazing runner.
A little bit.
But this is sort of a record with an asterisk, if we're being honest.
The other cool performance to come out of that weekend was that King Ches's girlfriend, named Sharon Locchetti, won the women's elite 5000 in her first professional race, which is super cute. And like, what an amazing power couple.
So fun. And that means they both took home some prize money.
Yep.
Went into a nice dinner. Maybe they're going to go somewhere with that prize money.
That'd be amazing.
Realistically, they'll just pay for their next races with that prize money.
I was going to say, you never know. I've previously had significant others who are also in the track world, and we would specifically enter road races with the intent of us both winning prize money so we could pay our rent that month. So, you know, do what you want with the money, but it's great that they both won it.
Bonding.
Bonding.
Bonding over shared experience. It keeps us all together.
It sure does. The Berlin Half Marathon also took place over the weekend.
So Safwan Hassan withdrew from the World Cross Country Championships, which we were bummed about.
Yeah.
Because she was, quite frankly, the headliner.
Mm-hmm. And I would have, side note, loved to see the showdown.
Between
Helen O'Beary and Safwan Hassan.
Well, we all wanted to see that.
Over that 10K competitive course.
I know.
Oh, man.
So exciting. Anyway, we didn't get to see it.
No.
But it was because she was taking a crack at the half marathon world record, which she unfortunately missed by a decent amount.
Yeah.
How much did she miss it by?
Well, the current world record is 104.51, and she ran 105.45. So she, put this in context, she did run one of the most competitive
half marathon
times ever.
Yeah, she for sure makes, you know, the all-time list.
Right. She won the race by over 3 minutes, but, you know, given that we knew that her goal going in was to break that world record, she fell quite a bit short of it.
Disappointment is a relative term.
It is.
Yeah.
Boston! Only a few days away.
Only a few days away.
Krista Duchesne is our only Canadian elite.
She's our only Canadian elite, but the weather looks crappy, folks.
Mm-hmm. And if you go back a couple episodes to our Around the Bay conversation with Krista Duchesne, she did tell us in that interview that she was hoping and praying that the weather would be just like last year, because obviously it worked well for her.
Canadians are tough. We run through the slop all winter.
Yep.
We run through the slop in the spring, because guess what, folks?
It snows in April.
And we then run you get the to slop for like 9 months of the year, really.
Yeah. And so then you get to Boston and it's crap and you're like, oh, this is just another Sunday long run.
Perfect.
You know, a few more spectators and downhills. But other than that.
Yeah. In fact, better because it's less snow.
Less snow.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, a little bit warmer.
Right.
It's balmy.
Balmy.
Mm-hmm. So Krista will be running the marathon. We are super excited for her. We will be watching that performance. And then we've also got Ben Flanagan and Justin Knight racing the Elite 5K. Super strong field, a bunch of former NCAA champions in that field, including obviously both Flanagan and Knight themselves. Yeah, they're just, you know, they're training together, they're buddies. It's nice to see them both on a start line representing Canada.
So it was a quiet weekend in the track world compared to the roads, but one amazing performer of the weekend was high jumper Mike Mason of BC, who jumped 2 meters 31 at the Sam Adams Invite in Santa Barbara, California. That was a world-leading jump, Maddie. He broke the facility record that was actually formerly held by Canadian Derek Drouin, and Mike Mason's performance was only 2 centimeters off his personal best of 2 meters 33. And for context, for our listeners who maybe aren't as well-versed in the world of field events, 231 is 7 feet 6 inches. So imagine throwing your body backwards over that. So Mike Mason, 3-time Olympian, he's been super consistent in his career. He has competed at pretty much every world championships, Commonwealth Games, Olympics that he has been a senior for. And he's obviously only getting better, so big things.
Fine wine.
Mm-hmm.
In the world of trail running, there wasn't any major races to report on, but our Canadian trail writer, Tori Schultz, just wrote a great article about brand new trail races across the country that will make great additions to your summer racing plans, even if you're a track or road runner, as we've seen with examples like Emily Setlock, Rob Watson, these various Canadians who have had great track and road careers. You know, making a foyer into trail running, even if it's, you know, just something a little bit shorter, it's fun.
Totally.
It's fun to break up the monotony. It's fun to try something new. And it's fun to just sort of change the way you approach the sport.
Yep. Good test for the body, too. So soft surface, first of all. And as long as you're careful with it, if you're inexperienced, getting in that ankle and lower leg strengthening work by getting on the uneven surfaces is never a bad idea. This has been your rundown for this week. Maddie, we'll chat soon.
See you then.
The 123rd running of the Boston Marathon is now only one day away. On Monday, 30,000 runners will toe the start line of this historic race before embarking on what is for many people the journey of a lifetime. Every runner understands the prestige of Boston and just how coveted the entries are. For most, meeting the aggressive qualifying standards and earning a spot on that start line even once is a significant accomplishment. But for today's guest, the race from Hopkinton to Boylston Street will be a very familiar experience. Meet Newfoundland's Derm Hallwell. The Ontario resident is a transplant from St. John's, but calls Boston his third home. On Monday, Derm will run his 29th consecutive Boston Marathon. I'll give you a second to let that sink in. Derm first made the trip to Boston in 1991. Throughout his nearly 3 decades of running the oldest continually held race in North America, he has seen incredible changes, not only to the marathon itself, but also to the running landscape more generally. I reached Derm at his home in Mississauga on Thursday during his final preparations for what has become a very special tradition.
The first time I ever would say I ran as a runner, I was 24. When I was 15, I started rowing in the St. John's Regatta, which last year had its 200th anniversary, and it's the oldest sporting event in North America. So I rowed for 4 years until I was 18. Then I took a break. I got married very young. So, and when I was 24, I started rowing again. And when I took up the rowing the second time, then we would get out of the boat and run around the lake, which was 2.5 miles around the lake. And that's how I started running. And a lot of St. John's marathoners, that's exactly how they started getting in shape for rowing. When I was 24, my neighbor was a marathon runner. And he was always bugging me to go and run with him. And I thought I could never run past, I think the longest I ran, the first time I went for a run with him was 7 miles, and I had never run past 4 miles. So I thought, oh, I could never do this. I got to 4 miles, and I remember thinking, man, this is really good. I could do this for a long time.
Although rowing was Durham's first athletic passion, it didn't take long for him to discover his inclination for and love of running. And, for better or worse, he jumped into it with both feet.
The regatta was the first Wednesday in August. I think on that Sunday, I ran a so we didn't have half marathons in St. John's in those days. It was very English, and we would run 20Ks. And so in 81, having not run much more than 4 miles in any one shot, I ran a 20-kilometer race on the Sunday. And then between that Sunday and the next Sunday, I ran 90 miles, including both Sundays. and I, let's say, screwed up my knee, but I still ran the marathon that year.
So you had, just so I understand, you had only ever done around 4 miles. You were sort of challenged to the 7-miler. And then from there, you were kind of bitten by the bug and decided to try this 20K. And then from there, you went into running a 90-mile week.
Yep. That was literally because of my neighbor. I would never have even thought of doing that if it wasn't for Gord Carrot.
So we've talked about how you got into running, but I want to know about the Boston streak. How did that start?
Anybody who's done any amount of running, I think, always has a goal of running Boston. And I don't know why I honestly remember this moment, but I can picture where I was at my house in St. John's. I can picture my father coming home, and I can picture sitting on my washer and Dad walking through the door. And the first thing he said to me was, "The Boston Marathon was today." And my father wasn't athletic in any way. I have no idea why he made that comment. I have no idea why it stuck with me. You know, once I started getting serious about running, then I thought, okay, I want to run the Boston Marathon.
Durham moved from Newfoundland to Ontario in the mid-1980s to pursue a degree in accounting. He didn't do a lot of serious running during those years, but always kept the dream of Boston on the back burner. Once he finished his degree, he decided that it was time to make that dream a reality.
The very first marathon that I did to get back into shape was actually the Sky Dome Marathon. It was inside the Sky Dome. It was the year after it opened. And I believe they limited it to 80 runners, but there was only 64 of us crazy enough to do it. And it was 76 laps of level 100 inside the Sky Dome. So I did that. And then in 91, then I started running in Boston. And, you know, in the beginning, I just wanted to do it once. So I qualified in Detroit that year in 90, I guess. And I think I ran like 2:52 or something. So I was all fired up and, okay, I'm going to Boston. So I started training, and I was doing like 60 and 70 mile weeks in November. And of course, then I got injured. And so I'd say the fire in me in terms of going to Boston sort of went away for a little bit. I sent my application in on March 11th, which was the last day. It had to be postmarked by March 11th. And it was basically, if you ran the qualifying time, you were in. There was no such thing as limits of numbers, you know. So, you know, I did the first one, and, you know, I was just, okay, I just want to do it. And the minute I finished, I was like, I have to come back here. I was so set on breaking 3 hours there. I think I ran 3:06 in my first one. Then, so next year I ran harder, trained harder, I should say, and ran 3:08. The following year I ran harder again, and I ran 3:14 on a 73 or 74 degree day. And I thought, oh my God, this is not as easy as I thought it would be. You know, after the third, then I thought, okay, in addition to breaking the 3 hour mark in Boston, everybody was looking ahead to the 100th, which was 3 years away. And believe it or not, in 1993, there was hotels that were sold out for 1996 for the 100th. I made it to that point. And then once we got past that point, I wanted to, you know, so I want to get the 10. And there was no magic to 10 in those days. There is now.
In the same way that he was bitten fast and hard by the running bug, Durham quickly became committed to maintaining his Boston streak for as long as possible. But this pursuit would not be without its challenges.
Then in 2007, the fall of 2007, I got a bit of a medical shock. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, so I had my prostate removed on January 28th of 2008. And at that point, I still hadn't registered. Wasn't sure I was going to be able to run. And so I left it. The day I decided to register, the race sold out. So my daughter, she's run Boston 9 times, I think. She called up and talked to the BAA and they couldn't do anything, but they suggested that I run for a charity. So that in the end, that's what I did, register for a charity. So it was kind of only at that point that I realized I really want to do 25 of these, you know, get to the 25 mark. And again, I didn't even know the magic of 25. I didn't know about the quarter century club. I didn't know about if you get to 25, you don't have to requalify again.
Before we talk more about the quarter century club, I have to mention here that the year Durham was diagnosed with prostate cancer and ran Boston as a charity fundraiser, he raised $14,000 for research into ovarian cancer, which is the leading cause of death of all reproductive cancers. As the name implies, the Quarter Century Club is a special group of runners who have completed 25 consecutive Boston marathons. Once in the club, the qualifying standards are waived, and so long as you complete each Boston marathon in under 6 hours, you can maintain your streak. There are currently 83 members of the Quarter Century Club, but only 4 Canadians, of which Durham is one.
Yeah, so that's, I got to 25, and, you know, now it's like, I have no desire to give it up. I'm not as, you know, I have more injuries these days than I ever did in the first, I mean, I've been running for 40 years now, almost 41 years. I've had more injuries in the last 4 or 5 years than I had in the first 35 or 36, but, you know, it, I mean, I guess that's to be expected. And I was always extremely lucky of not encountering injuries to start with. I think I have more than I deserve there in terms of, you know, being able to go year after year. You know, like the last 10 years, I've averaged 2,200 miles a year. And the 10 before that, I averaged 2,500 miles a year.
Just for reference, 2,500 miles is approximately 4,025 kilometers. That averages out to just under 80K a week.
So, you know, that's a lot of miles to get through and not be incurring constant injuries.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that because obviously to be at a point where you could not only be fit enough to qualify this many times for a race as prestigious as the Boston Marathon, but then to have the consistency in your health and your training to, you know, again, get you through the qualification and then to the race. I know you say that part of that is luck, but I would imagine that part of that is smart training too. Can you talk a little bit about why you think you've been able to maintain that health? And I know that you are very meticulous about keeping a detailed training log. And I think that's something that not everyone does, and it's not necessary per se, but certainly that helps. It helps to track the type of training you're doing and, you know, self-reflection and all of these things. Can you talk a bit about the value of tracking the training and then some of the ways that you've sort of worked to maintain your health?
In my early days of accounting, the only thing that I cared about was I knew I was good at numbers. So I didn't want to study law, didn't want to study economics. I thought, what does this have to do with accounting? But one of the very first courses I did that was not, let's say, a numbers-related course was management. And there's one thing that struck me very early in that course, and it was goal setting. And it said, those who set goals will achieve more even if they don't achieve their goals. So if you set a goal of running the Boston Marathon in 3 hours, you know, but you ran 306, for instance, was it a failure? You know, so that's one thing. Like going back to when I first started, I would go out and run. And then especially when I got serious and after I got sensible about it, not doing 90 miles from, you know, in 8 days when you've only run 4, once I got past that, I started having shin problems anytime I wore new shoes, anytime I took any kind of break and I'd start up again. I remember going to my doctor and him telling me, if you're getting shin splints, take 4 days off. You start back and you still got them, take 10 days off. And I actually did that. And I was amazed that it actually worked. Like there was a couple of times that I took 4 days off and it worked. There was once at least that it didn't work and I took 10 days off and then it worked. So, you know, my thought has always been since then is consistency in training. As far as my schedule, I'd say since my very early days when I got serious about marathoning, I sit down over between Christmas and New Year. Most times I plan out my whole year because effectively I know what races I'm going to do the following season. You know, I plan Boston is always in there. There's a 10-mile race in St. John's that I try to make it every year called the Telly 10, very, very fast course. So I fit that in there and I fit other races that I know I'm going to go to. And if you start building your schedule around what races you know, and you go, you want to recover from the race afterwards, you want to taper from your mileage just before the race. So it's very easy to build your miles up the weeks before and after. And before you know it, you don't have a lot left to plug in. You know, I just think if you set your goals early, you are more likely to, you know, if it's not to stick to it 100%. And I've actually had years where I have not deviated 1 mile in any week. And I know that's anal, but everybody should know their own body. And especially, as you get 4 or 5 years into marathoning, I think you learn quickly what you can and cannot handle.
You talked about goal setting and the importance of that. What are your goals for this year's Boston?
I basically judge on my age group. So 3 weeks from now, I'll be turning 65. Going back to when I was 40, you know, I've always placed high in my age group. The last few years, it's been going down and getting less and less. Now I am, you know, this year I will be literally one of the oldest in the age group because, like I said, I'm only 3 weeks from moving into a new age group. So early on, like I've had an injury since last May with my hamstring. So early on, my goal was to go under 3:20. The last few weeks, it's been acting up, again, but now the last few days, it's been much better. But, you know, I do have hopes, let's say, of being able to get back to doing regular track work and tempo runs this summer once we get past, once I get past this race. You know, overall, with my injury, I would love to get back. I honestly believe I have the ability to get back running under 3:20. The only thing that concerns me is it tends to be worse in rain and cold. So that part is at this point distressing. So my goal at this point is to run. I'd like to run under 3:30.
Although last year's Boston was just about the worst weather the race has ever seen, Durham doesn't seem overly concerned about a repeat of the nasty conditions, and he suggests that you shouldn't be either.
You can't change the weather. It is what it is. And you have to be prepared for everything, you know. And especially, like, we train all winter thinking as Canadians, we think we've run in the snow, we've run in the extreme cold. And then the other thing I always find, and I think most runners will agree with this, if you're, and I find this mostly in training, but if you look outside and you're going for a 10-mile run and it's raining out, you just have the most negative thoughts. I do not want to go out and run in this today. If you walk out the door and it's like just cloudy and everything is good and you get halfway through your run and it rains, you could care less. I always look at it as you either get wet from the inside out or the outside in. I'd rather create my own rain first and then if the other comes, then that's fine. I can live with that. But yeah, you know, hopefully we get a good day.
The Boston Marathon isn't only an important tradition for Durham. It's a family affair. Durham and his family members have a combined total of 60 Boston Marathons under their belt, and it's soon to be 63.
So my daughter and my son-in-law actually met at the Y track in Mississauga and eventually got married in the early years. Chris and I used to run almost dead even when I was 45, so 99 it was, we ran Chicago. And when I say we ran together, we literally ran together. We ran 2:49.11. So he was 25, I was 45. You know, so we tried running together a few times in Boston, never really did the whole race together. So Chris has run, I believe, 16 Bostons. Unfortunately, and he had 15 in a row. And unfortunately, his streak came to an end because of knee injuries. So he's got 16. My daughter has 9. And then Wendy has 7, I believe. So we leave tomorrow morning. We'll have 2 vehicles. There'll be 9 of us, my daughter, son-in-law, and 5 kids, and myself and Wendy. And this is new for Chris because Lori hasn't run, my daughter, hasn't run Boston since Hannah was 9 months old. So that's 13 years ago. And Chris is going to be on Harper Hill with 5 kids, all 13 and under. So hopefully we still have 5 kids when he picks us up at the finish line.
Well, good for all of you. That's real family commitment right there.
My grandkids, I have 7. 5 of the 7 have never missed the Boston Marathon. They get so excited leading up to it. The 13-year-old has been counting down. I drive them to school in the morning, the 2 oldest. And they constantly have been for the last 2 weeks. Papa, there's 8 school days left before Boston. Last year, Erin, who was 9 at the time, she slept over on a Friday night. Saturday morning, we're getting up. Wendy and I are getting up to go for our run. And we would bring her home before we go for our run. And so I go down and get my coffee, come back to bed. And I look down and Erin is starting to wake up. And she's turned sideways. And I look down and she's counting on her fingers. And I said, "What are you counting?" And she says, "The days before we go to Boston." So, you know, it's ingrained in them. Lori's 4 oldest are running in the 5K on Saturday morning. I'll be babysitting Saturday morning, but that'll be a lot easier than Chris's babysitting venture on Monday.
What are some of the most memorable Boston race experiences that you can think of?
I mean, the 100th, just because of the different things that happened there. You know, like I think my first year there was 6,800 finishers. And in those days, believe me, you had 6,800 finishers, you very likely had 6,800 starters. So then we get to the 100th and they opened it up to 26,000 qualifiers and 13,000 via the lottery. And it must have been a mix of something else because I know there was 40,000 there. They, for the longest while, it had the most runners ever for a marathon. So they go from that number to 40,000. And so, you know, now you have 30,000 and they run it in 4 waves. That 40,000 was run in 1 wave. The first 5 years I was there, there was no computer chip timing, which is just so hard. You know, I mean, it's even hard for me, and I experienced it, where, you know, you're coming down Boylston Street. When you turn onto Boylston Street, you have about 600 meters left to go in the race. So you turn onto Boylston Street and you look down and you think, okay, where do I have to go? Because there was a line of men, women, and they would have tape, kind of like police tape, and they'd be holding that. And they might move you from the left-hand side of the road to the right, and you finish in one lane, and that you could probably fit maybe 50 people in that lane. And you had to stay in the order that you were in. And then they would swing back, and they could swing 4 lanes over, 8 lanes over, and push everybody into another lane. And I thought, how will they ever keep that straight? And yet, you know, the next morning I'd wake up and get the newspaper. Everybody in those days, that was the first thing that you saw of your results, you know, because you couldn't look it up online or anything. So, you know, we go get the newspaper and your time is dead on. You think, how did they possibly do that? You know, and I can just see the race organizers being so stressed going into that 100th with the computer chip timing, because you just got to think, what if? And I know they have 2 backup systems, or a backup system, sorry. You know, and I know everything was done twice, but man, they had to be stressed out about that. And one thing I was always so proud of the Boston Marathon organization for this. In the 100th, just as I finished, I had to go to the medical tent. And it was just something stupid that I did, take an Advil, colon sinus instead of Advil, and I ended up dehydrated. Again, this is the first time, and those computer chips were relatively expensive in those days. So you had to tie them to your shoelaces. But as you exited, if you exited the normal way, there was a whole staff of people. You put your foot up on a stool and they would take your chip off. Well, going into the medical tent, they didn't want to waste any time putting anybody in the medical tent. So they actually cut my shoelaces as I was going in there. But when they cut my shoelaces, they handed me a pair of shoelaces to replace it with. I thought, how, like, to think of that degree, I was always so amazed at that, right?
Of course, Sturm says, the year he beat cancer was pretty special too. He and a friend, Andrea, who had been injured around the time of his surgery, decided to train together and make a push to run Boston, despite the short time frame and the odds being stacked against them.
I only had 7 weeks right to the day to train. Like, I was not allowed to run for 5 weeks. So when I started, I had 7 weeks left to train. So Andrea said to me, Durham, we'll do a mix of run and walk, and you only have to run 6 hours to keep your streak going. So, you know, let's do it. So we got 3 weeks into it. So now we're down to 4 weeks. And we started to think, okay, you know what? 4 hours is not an unreasonable goal. So we set 4 hours as a goal then. So we're 4 weeks out. 2 weeks later, we ran 20 miles. It was the only 20 miler that we did. So now we're 2 weeks out. And after that day, we decided, in the beginning, there was no intention of tapering because we felt we didn't have enough miles in that where we needed to taper. But by this point, we realize this is going much better than we expected. So we changed our goal to 340. Of course, by the time we get to race day, we decided, I don't know if we actually decided that we would bump it up anymore. I think it was more about we just started running and we could not keep ourselves to the pace that we needed. We just couldn't go that slow, let's say. We got to about 5 miles, and this is my numbers anal thing coming out of me. There was a lady up ahead that I'd been watching for the last 2 miles, and I was checking my watch every mile, and we were 8 minutes and 8 minutes. So I said to Andrea, let's run with this lady, and she's running very smooth and very steady, so we'll stick with her. She's from St. John, New Brunswick. Her number was 13447. So, and don't ask me why I remember. We stayed with her and we were running 801, 759, 8 minutes. And we made it to the hills and our time started to drop in the 3 miles of like the 19th, 20th, and 21st mile. We're actually faster than our miles earlier on. And I got to Heartbreak Hill, the top of Heartbreak Hill, which is at 20 and a half miles. And I thought, you know, there's lots of times you can get there and you can still crash. But I when I got there, I just knew, man, this is way better than we expected. You know, we go through the next 3-4 miles and we're both running really well. We've actually picked it up further than what we had in the hills. And we turned onto Boylston Street and Andrea says to me, Durham, I hate to say this, but if I push it here, I can beat my PB in Boston. So I said, go ahead. So I ended up running, I think it was like 325.55, and she ran very low 325s, and it was her PB in Boston, and it still is. And then, you know, the one that really is not a good memory is, you know, the bombing year. I think everybody has their own memories of that. We turned the TV on and one of Lori's daughters, who she would have been 7 at the time, she was the first one to see anything and, you know, started crying. And, you know, this is before we knew what was going on. But instantly, like, the phone started ringing, you know, people checking to see, you know, where we were and making sure everybody was okay and that sort of thing, right? One of my favorite memories, honestly, we'll never forget this. The The following year, they opened up the field. They added on 5,000 or 6,000 spots for people who were not able to finish the previous year. Security was crazy, but like, you know, just the way that everybody expected it, because, you know, things changed the day that that happened. And you know, they'll probably never go back to the way they were before. You know, you get to the starting line and places that we used to be able to just sit and rest, you can't do anymore. Everything is fenced off and that sort of thing. So the race starts and, like, you know, it's just everybody's so emotional, you know, about the, you know, what's happened the year before. And we got to probably, I'm going to say somewhere around 7 miles. And there's this pub and there's music just blasting from it as we're approaching it. And then as we get close, the song Sweet Caroline comes on. And you know the way that is at, you know, like baseball games and hockey games. So one of the runners, as we're approaching, one of the runners says, okay, everybody sing. And we started singing. And I had to stop singing. I just couldn't. I was getting emotional. I couldn't catch my breath. It was just, you just could not believe how everybody was so into it. Sweet Caroline. And then 30, 40 seconds in, everybody stops and realizes, okay, we are running a marathon here. And it went so deadly quiet. It's like all you could hear, the only thing you could hear was footsteps. And I will never forget that as long as I live. I just think that that's one of my favorite memories ever of running in Boston.
Durham has loved his times in the Boston Marathon, and he suggests that anyone who wants to be able to experience it for themselves can.
When Lori started running marathons, she was, I would say, 21 years old. Her first marathon was 4 hours and 37 minutes. You know, which is a far cry from qualifying for Boston, obviously. Then she, over her years, she's 45 now, she's run 16 PBs along the way, and her PB is 3 hours and 14 minutes. And, you know, she has 5 kids. In the beginning, like, she doesn't work these days, but until the third child was born, she worked. She ran marathons in between each of their kids. She's literally run marathons in between all the kids. For 3 of the 5 children, she has run on the day that the babies were born. She's run 5 days a week right through all her pregnancies. I just kind of want to make the point of, if you think that your life is too busy to do this, there is always a way. If you have a desire to run, if you have a desire to run a marathon, you can do it. And on top of that, I honestly believe almost anybody can qualify for Boston if that's the true goal that you have.
Thank you to Durham Hallwell for sharing his story and words of wisdom with us. Good luck to Durham and everyone else racing the Boston Marathon tomorrow. Pick up the latest print edition of Canadian Running Magazine and check out Durham's awesome article about how to prepare for Boston 2020. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Shakeout Podcast. Happy running, and we'll chat again soon.